From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. An English country mansion, visited by Queen Elizabeth I and Sir Thomas More, witnessed the murder of a child centuries ago. The culprit has apparently not yet been laid to rest. The Ghostly Villainess of Loseley Hall by B.M. Moffat. This is a true ghost story. Among famous English haunted houses, Loseley Hall near Guildford, Surrey, is by no means the least famous. I gladly welcomed the opportunity to visit it a few years ago. The bus set me down at the entrance to what I took to be a country lane, so sequestered was it, with thick hedges on either side and wide meadows stretching away beyond. It was not till I had reached its end, and the Elizabethan mansion suddenly appeared, that I realized that what I had taken to be a country lane was really one of the carriage drives. I still wonder how two traveling coaches could have passed each other in the good old days. I was just in time to join a group of people who had come to see that part of the house to which the public is admitted. We explored the banqueting hall, a truly magnificent apartment with its minstrel galleries and period furniture. We visited the drawing room, in which were portraits of past owners and their relatives and friends, including two kings and the martyred saint, Sir Thomas More. We were shown two stools, most carefully preserved, for the seats had been worked in wool by Queen Elizabeth I, who had visited the mansion no less than three times. Upstairs was the bedroom where the queen had slept in a canopied bed still preserved. The chief attraction to me was the glorious view from the windows of acres of sweeping cornland, running gold backed by the dark green of the woods beyond. From what I saw in the concrete beauty of old stone and craftsmanship, and from what I heard both then and subsequently, this account evolves. Close to 400 years ago, when the house was still relatively new, the second wife of the lord of the manor murdered her little stepson in his father's absence so that her son would inherit the property. When her lord returned and learned what she had done, he imprisoned her in an upper room for the rest of her life, though for how long a period that was or how harsh her imprisonment, there seems to be no record. That is the bare story that has come down the centuries. That she did not pay the penalty with her own life seems strange, but in those far-off days the law was very much in the hands of the individual. Perhaps, too, there was not sufficient evidence as to whether it was murder or accident. There are different versions of how the deed was accomplished. One is that the woman cut off her stepson's legs, and a picture was at one time painted showing the legless child sitting in his stepmother's lap. But a later artist painted out the horrid sight so that she now appears with her lap full of roses. Another version, and one that seems less gruesome, if not more likely, is that she drowned the child in the moat. But why she should have chosen such a method when a drink of poison or a pillow over his face would have been simpler is difficult to understand. On the other hand, there is no story that I could find of the moats being haunted, while there is a story of a haunted room. It is said that screams so terrible issue from this room on a certain night in the year that the family used to arrange to be away on that evening. There is another room with a reputation of being haunted, because of a feeling in it of great evil, possibly the room in which the stepmother was incarcerated. There seems to have been a long hiatus in the stories of the house from the 16th century to modern days, and then, In the prosaic 20th century, the house was taken by a friend of a cousin of mine. This friend was informed by her small daughters that they were never lonely when there was a party downstairs and they were left alone upstairs in bed, because a little old lady dressed in gray used to come in to see them. Curiously, the little girls had no fear of her, for they seemed to imagine that she was a resident of the house who came to keep them company when everyone else was downstairs, and they looked forward to her visits. Gradually, however, as they grew older and realized that the little old lady in gray was never seen by anyone else and was not willingly discussed by their elders, they sensed something uncanny and began to be nervous. So for this reason, the parents gave up the house. But was the apparition described by them as a little old lady in gray that of a woman who had murdered her stepchild, or another less malignant vision? The haunting or alleged haunting occasioned by a violent crime is not generally welcomed by either child or adult. Subsequently, the house was rented to a wealthy American lady who, upon the occasion of a house party, conceived the brilliant idea of getting a medium down from town to amuse her guests by calling up the spirit of the wicked stepmother. She got more than she had bargained for. Where one part of the house was reported to have been haunted, now the whole house seemed to be so. None of the terrified guests dared to go to bed that night, but packed their bags with trembling fingers. The dim light of early morning found guests, hostess, and servants at Guildford Station. The house was locked up and left empty. But before this wholesale departure, the hostess called servants as well as guests together. She asked each person to promise faithfully never to divulge what had been seen and heard on that night. Soon after, however, one of the guests met my cousin in London. In answer to the astonished query as to what she was doing in town at a time when she was supposedly a guest at Loseley House, she told my cousin of the hasty exodus and its cause. Details she would not give, saying that she had promised not to, but the one thing she did divulge was that the ghostly stepmother, called from her retirement, no longer inhabited one room, but might be met at any door or on any staircase, and that the house, once haunted by one entity, was now haunted by a legion. Another strange incident my cousin told me concerning Loseley House had to do with a large dinner party which was given there one winter night. Since extra help was needed for waiting on tables, a waiter was hired from Brett's, the caterers in Guildford. He was a quiet, elderly man who had been in good service in private families in his earlier days. A groom brought him to Loseley Hall in the dog cart, but the storm which had been blowing up all day was so bad by the time his duties were over that the housekeeper, not liking to send the old man back in such weather, persuaded him to stay the night. The following morning, when he came down to breakfast, the housekeeper asked him if he had slept well. "Oh, yes," he replied, "I slept quite well, but I'm afraid the gentleman who kept passing through in fancy dress didn't like my being there." And presumably the housekeeper was too dumbfounded to make any further inquiries. None of the guests had worn fancy dress in the preceding night. The room in which he had slept had been partitioned off from what had been a long gallery, which ran the whole length of the house. It was in that same gallery that a small dog, accompanying his master on a visit to the house, had become transfixed with fear, refusing to pass a certain spot. The owner carried his dog downstairs and dismissed the matter from his mind. Some time after, another visitor was being shown over the house, and he found on descending that his dog had remained behind. Calling and whistling were of no avail, and he returned to the gallery to find his dog whimpering piteously. A coincidence? It was strange that both dogs behaved in the same way, at the same place in which the old man thought he had seen people in fancy dress. Could it be that the pets detected indications of the lady in gray? The author and her husband, skeptics, could not explain in any normal terms the jarring phenomena that surrounded them. California's Haunted House by Miriam Allen DeFord. The following is a true ghost story. When the owner showed me the little cottage on a hill in Mill Valley, California, nearly 40 years ago, she made a strange remark. We were on the sun porch, which had big glass windows around three sides. If these windows ever break, she said, you'll have to pay to have them replaced. I assured her that it was very unlikely we would ever open them. But a few weeks later, I understood what she meant. The windows had heavy hasps, almost beyond my strength to move. On the windiest days, they stood firm. But often, on calm, clear days, one of them would suddenly fly open and bang against the trees outside. Finally, my husband, Maynard Shipley, tried to experiment. He went out on the sun porch and spoke aloud. If this is a demonstration of some sort of extrasensory power, he said, please find another way to demonstrate. We can't afford to have these big windows replaced if you break them. They never opened again. But that was not the first manifestation to occur in the little house, furnished with the owner's own belongings. One Saturday afternoon, I brought home a bag of fruit. My husband picked out a pear and observed that it was too pretty to eat, polished it, and laid it on the bare center table in the living room. We were both sitting near the table reading, he facing it and I with my back turned to it, when I heard a strange bumping sound. Subconsciously, I counted. There were 12 bumps in all, in rhythmic pairs. I thought he was kicking a table leg and asked him to stop. He did not answer, and I turned around to see his eyes fixed on the pear. I was just in time to see its last two vibrations. It was jumping up and down, rising about 2 inches each time. Perhaps this is the place to explain that neither my husband nor I believed, nor do I now. He died in 1934 in occult phenomena. He was a writer and lecturer on scientific subjects. I was and am a freelance writer and a labor journalist. We were both agnostics with no faith in survival of the personality after death. But we both had open minds and we could not deny the evidence of our senses, though the experiences we underwent made neither of us a spiritualist convert. In fact, my husband's first thought was that the pear was abnormal, perhaps that some parasite was in it. He cut it open, and it was perfectly sound. As he lifted it from the table, there was a tinkle like that of a silver bell, and a tiny whiff of white smoke arose from below the table and was dissipated in the air. That was the first peculiar phenomena we witnessed in the cottage. Here are some of the others. I am not including any that were not seen by at least two persons. There was a whirring metallic sound sometimes that we tried in vain to locate. Finally, we went into the bedroom, the doors and windows of which were closed so that there was no breeze. Hanging on a nail on one of the doors was a metal coat hanger, which was vibrating like mad. In the bathroom was an old-fashioned bureau with drawers which had brass pulls so stiff that they stayed in any position in which they were placed. Twice when my husband entered the room, all the brass pulls began to dance up and down. In the kitchen was a wooden gadget fastened to the wall, on whose arms we hung various utensils, basting spoons, can openers, spatulas, things of that sort. Frequently, when Maynard approached them, all of these started to vibrate. A door led from the kitchen to the bedroom. It was always closed at night. Every night, precisely at 11, there would be a sound like that of a wet mop striking the kitchen side of the door. When it was open, nothing was there. We brought home a trailing piece of wild blackberry vine and put it in a hanging vase on the living room wall. It started to swing back and forth like a pendulum and kept it up for 48 hours. Maynard tried to account for this on scientific grounds and, in fact, had an article published in the Scientific American in which he discussed the movement as a possible effect of radiant energy on a living plant, since it happened to be halfway between a window into which the sun poured and a wall light which was on at night. But later, when we tried the experiment, With many other plants, the vase did not swing at all. We heard constant raps, day and night, and nearly every evening, small bluish-green lights, like faint electric bulbs, used to move horizontally across the room, about 4 feet from the floor, and then vanish. This happened in both the living room and the bedroom. In the living room was an old-fashioned Franklin stove. All the furniture was of turn-of-the-century vintage, which burned wood. In its lid was fixed a common iron stove lifter. One night, in full electric glare, we saw this lifter raise itself about 3 inches from the lid and sail horizontally across the room, dropping with a thud on the floor at the other end of the living room. Another time we saw a large china bowl on the top shelf of an open china closet in the kitchen lifted as if somebody had hold of it and deposited gently on the floor beneath. It was not even cracked. But the prize exhibit was the folding bed. For those who never have seen an object, it is a bygone piece of furniture, which when closed is just like a big closet door against the wall. This one was in the living room, and we never thought of using it until I was ill with a flu. My husband tried to sleep in it. It opened out into a regular double bed. I say tried, because every time he got into it, he had the distinct impression that he was not alone, that somebody else he couldn't see was in the bed, somebody who didn't want him in it. He stuck it out for 3 nights, and then he said, "Well, if you want the bed, you can have it," and got out and spent the rest of the night in a chair. After I was well, we decided to try an experiment with a weekend guest. Our visitor told everybody that she was a natural medium and a devout believer in spiritualism. So without mentioning anything about the bed, we put Genevieve in it. About 2 o'clock in the morning, there was a knock on the bedroom door. Genevieve said she couldn't sleep in that bed because somebody else was in it. We fixed her up on the sun porch, but we never told her why we had given her the folding bed. We found our Mill Valley's ghost extremely interesting, and we hated to leave them when the owner decided to sell the house and we had to move. Later, the house was destroyed in a fire which burned all that part of the town. We never had anything again approaching the crowding phenomena of our haunted house. But perhaps the ghosts did follow us for a while in San Francisco, and later in Sausalito, where we lived until my husband's death. One day I received a letter telling me of the death of a very dear old friend. That evening, Maynard and I were washing and drying dishes together in the kitchen of another rented cottage. We were facing the window, and it was very dark outside. I was talking to Maynard about my friend, whom he had never known, when suddenly there was a crashing blow at the window, enough one would think to have broken it. "Cats," Maynard said, and we went outside to look. No cats, no anything. He came in again, and we started to talk it over. It came again, just the same as before. This time, we didn't even look. Almost the same thing happened later in another house. This time, we were in the dining room. I was seated with my back to the front window, which looked on the porch. My husband sat opposite me, facing it. Again, we were talking about somebody recently dead, and again there was a smashing blow at the window. This time Maynard caught a momentary glimpse of something round and white that had struck the blow, but when we both dashed out on the porch seconds afterwards, there was nothing whatsoever there. In the apartment in which we first lived in Sausalito, there was a big bare kitchen with wooden walls. On a nail on one of the walls hung several big paper shopping bags. We had a close friend whose husband had one day taken a train for a short business journey and had never been seen again. No trace was ever found of him, and nobody knows to this day whether he is alive or dead, though it is probable that he is dead. One morning at breakfast, we were talking about our friend's dilemma. After searching and waiting for several years, she had decided to get a divorce to remedy her anomalous position. "My own belief is that Charlie is dead," my husband said. At which moment, suddenly, with no breeze anywhere, all the paper shopping bags on that nail raised themselves slowly to a horizontal position and then slowly fell back again. If either of us could be considered a physical medium, whatever that really is, it was not I, but my husband, in whose presence metallic objects shook and danced. After he died, I would have given anything, including my life, for some evidence that something of him still lived and could communicate with me, as we had often promised each other to try to do, if it were possible, but it never came. There was just one slight and unexplained happening. About a week after his death, while I was still living alone in our Sausalito home, preparing to leave it, one of our friends came to visit me. We were sitting before the fireplace, and I was saying to her what I must have just said above. There was a silence, and then we both distinctly heard a strange sound. It was like a large, soft, heavy object falling to the ground from a short height. The nearest analogy I could think of was a bag of laundry. We searched the house systematically from cellar to attic. Nothing was disturbed, nor was there anything out of position that in the least resembled what we both had heard. Nothing of the sort ever happened to me again. It was not enough evidence. Only twice in my life before I met Maynard have I had inexplicable experiences. Once in 1917 in Hollywood, I saw a phantom of the living, so distinct that I took it for granted it was the man himself, and spoke to him when he vanished. And later that same year in Spokane, a friend whom I was visiting and I both heard heavy footsteps climbing the cellar stairs to the locked kitchen door, and then cross the floor. We not only searched the house, but we called a policeman, who searched again for us with a bored air that we soon understood when a week later, at precisely the same hour, the whole thing happened over again, and several times more. This, too, was a rented house, and apparently the police had often been called to find the phantom burglar. I never heard any story to account for this. In our Mill Valley house, I made inquiries and discovered that the owner had lived in the cottage with her old father until he died, and that he slept in the folding bed. That was all. I might add that after we left, she was unable to sell the house after all and rented it again. I was told by neighbors that it was rented 3 or 4 times before the fire, but that nobody ever stayed more than a month or two. As for my husband, he had one other strange experience during our years in Sausalito, though it did not occur there. I tell it to complete the record, though he had only a quasi-witness. In the course of a lecture tour in Northern California, he had a speaking engagement in the town of Woodland. He could not get a hotel room and had to take a room for the night in an apartment over a grocery store. All night he was kept awake by constant sawing and hammering downstairs. Apparently, the grocery store was being repaired or remodeled, and the workmen, for some reason, were doing the job at night. He was very much annoyed when he paid the landlady in the morning, and was about to make some caustic comment when she said, with a queer mixture of bravado and timidity, "Were you able to get any sleep in that room?" Puzzled, he glanced in at the store when he got outside. It was precisely as he had seen it the night before, when he went there after his lecture. There was no sign that any carpentry had been done on it. Just how and why we should have had that intensive period of unexplained phenomena for the year and a half in Mill Valley, gradually tapering off for 3 or 4 years more, and then never recurring, neither of us ever knew. The last thing I can remember of this nature that we experienced was also in our last Sausalito house. One moonlit night, I happened to glance from a front window and saw on the steps leading to the front porch a curious thing, a sort of cone of light, about 2 feet tall and about 1 foot at the base, milky and solid-looking in texture. We both went out and stood directly above it. There it sat, looking like crystallized soap suds, but with a line of the steps visible through it. It glowed faintly, as if with its own light. No moonlight struck anywhere near it. Maynard was all for stooping down and touching it, but I held him back. I had a foolish, nervous feeling that it might give him an electric shock or be in some other way unpleasant to touch. Just then an automobile passed the house, down our hilly street, and instantly the cone vanished. If it had been some trick of light which the auto's headlights had reversed, it should have reappeared when the car had passed. It did not return, and we never saw anything like it again. It was some time later that occurred to us that the thing, whatever it was, resembled pictures we had seen of ectoplasm. If my husband was one of those people somehow in tune with so-called parapsychic phenomena, it seems peculiar that he had not had similar experiences in the past, instead of just during this limited period. It may have been that for some reason he was in a particularly receptive condition in those years, or it may have been that I, though not myself a medium, in some way supplemented his receptivity. The whole question in one which, beyond our powers of explanation, there can be no such thing as a supernatural, he used to say. Everything that occurs is a part of nature. All we can say is that these things occurred, that they were not subjective, and that therefore they will be susceptible to scientific explanation some day, even though they are not now. In an attempt to secure some informed outside judgment of the phenomena, we wrote an account of them and sent it to Dr. Walter Franklin Prince of the Boston Society for Psychic Research. He was extremely interested, though no better able than we to explain our experiences, and intended to publish the account in a forthcoming volume in a series of human experiences, based on an extensive questionnaire sent out by the Society, but he died before another volume could be compiled. After Maynard's death, I again wrote a statement of what had happened in the Mill Valley house and sent it to Harry Price, the well-known English psychic researcher. He, too, was both interested and baffled. About all one can say at the present stage of our comprehension is that the house was haunted, whatever that word really means, and that we, and especially my husband, were susceptible media through which the haunting became objectified. Any more satisfactory elucidation will have to come, for me at least, as a result of further subjective investigation on a purely scientific basis. I offer this detailed description, minus dubious or very minor phenomena, and those witnessed by only one person, as a document for such research. The impulsive girl with dreamy blue eyes died mountain climbing. Why then did she refuse to disappear? The Scottish girl who came back, by A. X. Elfer. The following is a true ghost story. There are experiences one is reluctant to relate, be it from personal inhibition or for fear of the scoffing tongue, experiences appearing in retrospect like a dream or something one has read in a book. Yet the evidence of memory is unequivocal. These events occurred in every substantial detail precisely as I am about to tell them now. It all began a good many years ago in the Scottish village where I lived. At the age of 13 or 14, I met a somewhat older, fair-haired girl with long eyelashes and a dreamy expression, as though her thoughts were far removed from her surroundings. Perhaps they were. Her father, a sculptor, had died of tuberculosis, and she had been brought up by her uncle, who was a professor of ancient philosophy somewhere in Europe. She discoursed nimbly on Plato and Aristotle, and not knowing much of either, I was duly impressed. However, a fly in the ointment there would be, and one day my dreamy friend was surprised in the act of stealing money from her teacher's coat. What could have led her to this ridiculous larceny is hard to imagine, but she was expelled from her school. She left our neighborhood, and so our brief contact ended, Plato and all. Years passed. As a young student, I was spending a climbing holiday at a mountain resort, and there she was again, grown up and rather beautiful, with the same dreamy blue eyes. I passed the time of day with her once or twice in the street, but did not carry our conversation further. There was just that little awkwardness, an invisible barrier between her and me. Possibly as a result of her earlier disgrace, she had an obvious desire to excel, and excel she did, as a climber. With her younger sister and without companions or guides, she had done some of the most difficult climbs in the area. This not unnaturally created a flutter of admiration among the other climbers, but I could not help feeling that there was something a little unhealthy about it, and it was that, rather than the memory of her expulsion, that produced the awkward feeling between us. She was, in any case, engaged to a young doctor, so that romantic interest on my part was further ruled out. However, there was an unclimbed face in one little frequented valley that had rather caught my fancy. The rock was limestone of evil repute, and I could not persuade anybody to join me in an attack on that face, which was too difficult to tackle alone. My holiday was nearly over, and my thoughts turned toward the sisters. I did, in fact, progress so far as to put my finger on the buzzer of their door one morning, but at the last minute I changed my mind. Next day I saw the two girls make for the hills, with rucksacks and ropes, and the day after I left the place without making my climb. A few days later, an American friend told me the sisters had been killed in an accident on the day I had left. It did occur to me that I had pressed the buzzer, they might not have gone on that fatal expedition. But I put this thought as far away from my mind as possible, dismissing it with a sententious observation that foolhardiness was not the same thing as courage, and if one persisted in it, trouble was bound to follow. A month went by. I was reading for an examination, and in going through my books, I came across a slender volume. I recognized it at once. It had been given to me by a dreamy-eyed schoolgirl who had been expelled from her school for larceny. Instantly, I had a strong feeling that she was standing behind me. I turned around. There was nothing to be seen. And yet, although there was no visual image, by some strange sense, tactile rather than optical, possibly something like a scanning radar beam, I could make out the whole of her figure with an amazing precision. She was standing in the middle of the room, motionless, her toes inward, head on one side with a little smile. One of the white buttons on her blue blouse was undone. For some minutes we looked at each other, and then the sensation vanished. It was late. I went to bed disturbed. All through the night I had one unvarying dream. The girl was holding me tight by the right wrist and leading me across a bog. She never turned towards me, never spoke a word, but I knew that I had to follow her or lose my footing and be instantly drowned. I woke up with a start, yet, though wide awake, I had no power to do so much as quiver an eyelid. There was a hand on my forehead, an elbow on my chest, and my face was smothered with long, fine hair. It was pitch dark, and I could see nothing. After a while, the hair moved and lifted. First the hand, then the elbow were gone. I regained control of my muscles and turned on the light. After lying awake for half an hour or so, I turned off the light and fell asleep once more. The same dream continued. Next morning, as I walked through the streets, I could feel her at my side. As I was passing a Catholic church, I remembered that she was a Catholic. Something urged me to go in and pray for her, but as an agnostic, I dismissed the idea. This was undoubtedly a wrong thing to do, and I was properly punished for it. Day in, day out, in the streets and crowded lecture halls, on trams and buses, I could feel her presence beside or behind me, and yet nowhere in particular. Not for a minute did she leave me alone, except at night. No dreams, no ghosts troubled me through the hours of darkness, with one notable exception. I had moved to different rooms. A street light was shining into my window as I woke up in a state of unpleasant excitement, a pulse thudding hard in my throat. I sat up in bed with a feeling that something unusual was about to happen, though there was nothing to indicate it. When, however, I looked at my wardrobe, which had an oval mirror on its front, I noticed that the outline of the mirror was quivering as though hot air were rising in front of it. Then a kind of gray mist spread thinly like tissue paper, it appeared to have no dimension and depth, crept into the trembling area and began to shape slowly into a human figure, down to the waist. The apparition was wrapped in gauze, gray, motionless, and lifeless. Oddly, I found later that her body had been wrapped in gauze to conceal mutilations suffered in her fall. Her eyes were closed, lips slightly parted. There came a flash resembling that of an electric spark. A pink light flickered in the cheeks of the apparition, and the eyelids moved slightly. A moment, and the eyes would open. She might even speak. But a perverse devil at the back of my mind flashed a thought hurtful to the person of the ghost, without any conscious will on my part. There was a faint swoosh. More electric sparks, the whole thing turned round edge-on and vanished. For, as I said, it was perfectly flat, without any dimension in depth. I lay down on my bed and turned to the wall. Out of the solid masonry, her face, pink this time, with eyes open, was looking at me, almost point-blank and yet somehow far away. Then it grew smaller and smaller still, as though receding without change in position, and disappeared. I saw no more ghosts, much as I wanted to see them in order to get to the bottom of it all. But the presence continued. I had passed my exam. The autumn term ended. I packed up and left for the mountain resort where she was buried. It was a frosty, clouded, moonless December night when I reached the vast graveyard on the outskirts of the town. Adjoining it were empty fields, a small wood, a power station humming beyond a rapid river. In the mortuary at the entrance to the cemetery, I had been told a body lay on a table awaiting a post-mortem after an accident. The huge wrought-iron gate was wide open. Midnight was approaching. I entered and proceeded along the central alley, flanked by marble angels, obelisks, Gothic spires and cast iron, granite slabs and crosses. As I passed, it seemed to me as though there were a kind of electric discharge from each monument, rather like the hiss one hears sometimes on a mountain ridge at the approach of a storm. Possibly this was the echo of my own footfalls. Otherwise, everything was quiet and peaceful. I had no fear. In the dim twilight of the town's lights reflected from the clouds and the thin sprinkling of snow, I could pick my way without using my flashlight, but I did not know the location of the grave I was looking for. I had never asked. In the darkness ahead, I could see a faint light, and I made straight for it, abandoning the path. I strode boldly on, and to my horror, walked straight into a newly dug grave. I was lithe and strong and scrambled out of it without much difficulty, but it was distinctly unpleasant. I continued on my way more cautiously. The light I had seen came from an oil lamp below a small alabaster Madonna in a niche in a granite block. I ran my flashlight over the inscription. It conveyed nothing to me. It was not the place. On my right, the tombs ended. I could see a stretch of untouched grass among the bushes. I turned that way and soon noticed a tall wooden cross with faded wreaths of mountain pine at its foot. I knew at once that this was it. So there I was, standing with bowed head at her grave. I prayed for her as best I could and asked her to rise and tell me if she had any message. A great stillness lay unbroken over the frosty night, except for the sound of the flowing river and the hum of the power station. Nothing happened. I do not know how long I stood thus, but there came upon me a feeling of friendliness and gratitude like a warm flood, and it held me bound to the spot. In the end, I said my goodbye and turned toward the exit. Perhaps this had been more of a strain than I realized, but as the gravel of the main alley crunched under my feet, I had a feeling that a silent crowd was gathering behind my back, and I could feel the hair on the back of my neck begin to rise. "I will not run, I will not run," I repeated through my clenched teeth, and walked steadily on. 100, 200 yards. The crowd's silence, invisible, was growing behind me, as if those in every tomb joined as I passed, a kind of funeral in reverse. Here was the gate and the mortuary. As I stepped between the posts, a loud clang shook the ironwork as though I had been hit with a sledgehammer. For a moment it seemed that the gate was going to close upon me, but it settled on its hinges and remained still. A cold terror gripped me, but I was a scientist by training. It was the frost. The rusty iron bolts securing the hinges had contracted, and the vibration of my footfalls was enough to burst one of them. That was all there was to it, perhaps. My will asserted itself. I spun around on my heels and faced the alleyways. But there was nothing, nothing at all. A wide path, thinly sprinkled with snow, and on its side, marble angels, obelisks, crosses, and cast-iron Gothic spires. For a moment I fancied a lone white figure at the far end, but even this showed itself finally to be a monument of some kind. I stood there for a few minutes to quiet the action of my heart, then walked away briskly to the main road. I had won my victory. The fatal bond was severed. No presence troubled me any more. Yet, since then, I seem to have lost my love of visiting graveyards, even by day. If somebody tells you that the arrangement of acids in the chromosome chains of the living cells exhausts the mystery of life, take it with a generous pinch of sodium chloride.